Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sam. And while we're waiting for questions, I wanted to make just a couple of announcements. I wanted to repeat the verification code for those of you who are interested in getting continuing education credits. So the verification code for this session is the number 9, the numeral 9, N like national, I like immunization, C like conference, O like online, 2012. And then a reminder that the posters are available for viewing at any time on the main conference webpage, and that the slides and recordings of all presentations will be posted online within about a week. And again, you would go to the main conference page to check for updates there. And Mary Beth, I did have a couple of questions for you that have come in. Do you have a sense of when we can expect the updated administration fee rates that you mentioned?
Yes, we're in the process, in the rulemaking process, on updating the administration fee rates, and we're hoping that that will come out in the very, very near future. We're also in the regulations process for the primary care bump up, and we also expect that those will come out in the near future as well. And I know there was a question that came in on some specific for that, whether local health departments who administer vaccines will be able to receive increased vaccine administration fees. And unfortunately, because we are in the rulemaking process, we cannot answer specific questions on that. But again, we hope that this information will become public, that this net proposed regulation will be out potentially in just a few weeks.
Great, thank you. And then one other question for you, Mary Beth. Could you clarify whether the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, requires coverage of administration fees for all vaccines or just for some vaccines?
It requires coverage of administration fees for, in this provision, it requires coverage of administration fees for qualified providers. And again, that will be defined in the regulation. I think that's the best way to answer it. But yes, it does, for as long as they're using the codes that are identified or the successor codes.
Okay, thank you. And Melinda, there's a question for you. I'm wondering if you have any projection of anticipated future funding directions for 317 at this point?
Thanks, Nancy, for that question. I think it's a little hard looking forward to predict, but given the sort of scrutiny that federal expenditures are under, I think that there will be hard looks at 317, and that we'll really need to really think particularly about how the vaccine dollars are utilized. The billing projects should help us get those fully insured people covered by private insurance if they do end up being vaccinated in public health departments. And so $317 won't be being used to vaccinate them. And we hope, as the Affordable Care Act is implemented, that the issues of underinsured people will be addressed. So, but I think that there will be a lot of scrutiny of these funding lines, and we're not expecting increases, and I think that there will be a lot of downward pressure on federal budget expenditures just because of the whole tenor of things. That said, there's been a lot of support for the program over the years, and I think we're hopeful that that given the clear cost effectiveness of immunization, how important this is for public health, that we will be able to continue the programs in a way that they're really effective and that we can move them forward into the modern era.
Thanks, Melinda. And Mary Beth, I have another question for you, and I believe that it has to do with the temporary bump up in vaccine administration fees. But if I'm incorrect, then I hope the questioner will repose it. But the question is, Will VFC administration fees be increased under this proposed revision? So I'm not sure if that related to the bump up or to the new rate schedule that, or maximum rate that schedule that's going to be published.
Okay, thank you, Nancy. I can answer it for, well, let me answer for the proposed regulation that will increase the administration fees. It will, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we have not updated the administration fees since they were originally published back in 1994, the maximum rate for each state. And so the proposed rule that will be published, hopefully in the near future, will provide a new maximum for each state. Of course, the state then has the flexibility to set their administration fees. So, so while the federal maximum will be increased through the rulemaking process, as far as the state's administration fee, that is up to the state. So hopefully that answered the question. If there's more to the question, again, like Nancy said, please let us know.
Great. Thanks, Mary Beth. And Melinda, this next question seems like a hard one, so I'll give it to you. The question is, as an employee health nurse, I'm interested in having all healthcare providers' vaccination status go electronic. It will save a lot of resources as making copies of vaccination records or doing, in terms of doing, making copies of vaccination records or doing titers. How to make this a reality?
Well, it, you know, I think that there, that clearly as the healthcare system modernizes, we are moving into the electronic area of electronic health records comprehensively. And, you know, there are incentives for providers to move toward electronic health records and establish meaningful use. And I think these are going to be across the entire health sector, these efforts to move us into a more modern area of record keeping. You know, it doesn't take a lot of the vaccines are expensive. And when records are missing and can't be located and doses have to be given, there's a lot of extra cost in the system. So I think that it clearly will be an electronic record keeping is clearly going to be an improvement. We've got immunization information systems which are now able to capture immunization information on people of all ages in many states. And as providers increasingly adopt electronic health records and as those interfaces are worked out and established, I think that the both the populating of the immunization histories in both as well as the ability to interchange data is going to be increasingly robust. And it's one of the things that's really very exciting going forward. So I can't specifically answer the question about how to make it happen, but I think that there are a whole variety of factors in the health system that are pushing us in this direction.
And one additional thought from the moderator is that I'm not sure where the what state the questioner was in, but I would encourage anyone who's interested in sort of the status of this in their location to check with their state health department, because all state health departments are working on immunization information systems and connections with electronic health records, and they would have a good sense of the status of that in any particular location. So that's another possible resource for you.
Oh, that's a good point.
And Sam, I have a question for you. There's interest in knowing how challenging it is to obtain permission from school systems and parents for school-located pandemic-related vaccination. I'm not sure if we know the answer to that, but
I think it really probably is a challenge, and I think it's something that probably varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But I think the challenges really kind of highlight the importance of really communicating the need for immunizations and the advantage of school-located vaccinations. So the more that I think immunization programs and preparedness groups really kind of develop the message and really communicate the issues to the public and to administrators, the more success we'll have.
Well, and can I add something to that, Sam? This is Melinda. You know, I think that school-located vaccination is one of those things that really seems like it should work. And in terms of thinking about the history of 317, there was all this early work done around polio vaccination, of course, most of which was done because of the lack of immunization infrastructure in the 1950s and early 60s, really was focused in school-based vaccination, as far as I know. And so to the extent, rather than waiting for the emergency, we can figure out how to do this in a more routine way that we work out the kinks, we learn how to do it, we learn how to deal with the record keeping and the consent and the financial issues as well as parental acceptance, then I think that we're far better off in dealing with the next event that might be far worse than the recent pandemic was. You know, I've got kids in school. I've got school-age children, and every school year, there's a large bundle of papers that come home with my kids that I have to be signed and returned, usually with checks attached, related to a whole variety of things. And it's not hard to imagine that we could have, as part of that initial paperwork at the beginning of the school year, you know, did I want my child to receive a flu shot at a school-located clinic in the fall once the vaccine's there, and, you know, provide my insurance information and provide consent, and that it could be handled in the same way all those other things that schools, that at least schools can manage the paperwork. Obviously, we all know there's infrastructure issues with schools actually delivering vaccine because there's not healthcare personnel in schools, but there are community vaccinators who can provide these services in schools for school-located vaccination. So I do think that the more we can work, figure out how to do this in normal times, the better off we'll be when unusual things are going on.
Thanks, Melinda.
Thanks, Dr. Horton. I think it's an excellent point. And it's also one of the reasons why really in the 317 program, we're really looking at the awardees in the future to really have school-located vaccination really a primary focus of not only all their programs, but really for use of their pandemic, their preparedness funds and their initiatives.
Thanks, Sam. We have another question that is asking what CDC is doing to make HMOs more compliant in facilitating reimbursement in public settings, such as local public health. And one of the things that CDC is doing is working closely with a fair number of our awardees at the present time on what's informally been called the Billables Project. And this is an effort to help state health departments plan and then implement a way to bill either HMOs or commercial insurers for fully insured people or HMO members who come to a local health department for their immunizations. And so our best source of information about this now is those states that have implemented this. And my sense is that the person here at CDC is working and sort of leading this effort will soon be in a position to probably publish, not publish in a peer-reviewed setting perhaps, but make public some of the lessons learned and best practices that will help others do this. And so if there's more to be shared about that, we can have him follow up. And Melinda, I don't know if there's anything more you'd want to say about that.
Well, I mean, I think fundamentally the issue is the challenges of becoming an in-network provider. And at least it's my understanding that, you know, this has tended to require basically establishing contracts with different insurers or third-party payers, potentially with each local health department. And, of course, that's a pretty challenging thing to do, that if you haven't done it before, it's really difficult. And so this is why CDC has been working with some of our state health departments on these projects for several years now. And we do think this is a very important effort going forward. There's a lot of different pieces of what it's going to take to get everybody vaccinated and get the right people to pay for the vaccination and all the different places people could choose to be vaccinated. But this whole issue about becoming a in-network provider, both for public health that end up providing services to fully insured people, but also for the community vaccinators and the pharmacists that that can really extend the availability of immunization, but in order to get the benefits of that improved insurance coverage, they really do need to be in-network providers. So I think this is an across-the-board challenge, and you know, we have been and continue to work with America's health insurance plans at a national level on these issues, but I think there's definitely some continued efforts that are going to be needed in this over the next couple of years to make all the things happen that need to happen.
Thanks, Linda. Mary Beth, I have a question that you may be able to answer. I'm not sure, but the question is, does CMS immunization billing data link into any state immunization registry at this time?
Thank you, Nancy. Yeah, I'm not a financial expert, so but I feel fairly confident saying that the answer to this is no, because the information that CMS gets from the VFC program is similar to what we get from states and other programs because it's part of the federal match. So it comes directly from the state Medicaid program. So I am fairly certain that the answer is no, and frankly, the fact that I'm not aware of it makes me think that we aren't directly working with immunization registry programs in states. But I will also do some more research on this, and we can follow up if we need to.
Okay, thank you. We have a question about babies who are born or are vaccinated in infancy against hepatitis B. The question is, when babies are born, they receive hepatitis B vaccine, 3 doses. How do we know if when they grow up, they ever developed antibody after 3 doses? Now new hires come in. We do screening of their vaccination status. Do we check the vaccination record and do a titer? And I know what my answer would be, but I'm going to go for Melinda first.
Thanks, Nancy. Actually, this isn't the direct. This issue about the duration of protection of hepatitis B vaccination, specifically for healthcare workers who never had immunity documented after an initial series, because they received vaccination earlier in life, is something that I think the ACIP Hepatitis B Vaccine Working Group is currently discussing now, so there may well be some new guidance about this coming out
The
near future.
Well, that's better information than I had, so thank you. Sam, I think this might be for you. The question is, could you please provide the information on the entity that made mass/local vaccine clinic successful?
Well, sure. The example, first of all, there are many examples of successful mass vaccination clinics. The example that I highlighted in my presentation was of the Larimer County Health Department. And on the slide, and I'll go ahead and read you the website that I have for the material, and it's all publicly available, but the website is www.phethos.org. And it's also on the slide, and I believe the slides will be available online as well. But there are many other examples out there, but this happened to be one that we know that seemed a really efficient method. I think that all these programs really have to be adapted to local situation and circumstances. But I think it's a good starting point.
And I have another one for you, Sam.
Okay.
How do you balance school-located vaccination with the importance of maintaining medical homes for primary care?
Well, it's a good question. I think it's important to realize that school-located vaccination clinics should not be seen as replacement for primary care, that regular checkups and physician interactions with physicians and other healthcare providers are an important part for children and for growing up. And so I think it really, in many ways, school-located vaccination should improve the quality of care for primary care.
Okay.
Hope that answers.
Well, and I think especially for influenza vaccine, where if we really were going to get everybody vaccinated every fall who's recommended to receive an influenza vaccine, there's just not enough medical office space to mm-hmm. do it during that really short period of time where we want all that vaccination to take place. So I think that especially for influenza vaccine, these alternative immunization locations can be a very important adjunct to the medical home to help get particularly the children who don't have, they're not the children with asthma, they're not the children who really are receiving chronic care, but for the ones who might not have a well child visit and would really take an extra visit to the doctor to get them vaccinated. It seems like for those children as well as healthy adults generally that these alternative vaccination sites are probably critical to helping us achieve high coverage with influenza vaccine. Otherwise, I don't think healthcare providers would be able to do anything else for about 3 months of the year, which is probably not a good use of those resources.
Okay.
The question had to do with getting consent for children at school located vaccination for school located vaccination and there's a variety of ways this has been done. Paperwork can be sent home with the kids, and it may or may not come back. The parent can come. I think this is one of those things that we have to learn how to do. And in some of the school located vaccination programs that have been implemented, there certainly have been some challenges with this particular aspect. So I think it's something that we will need to learn better how to accomplish effectively so that each piece of paper is in fact matched up to a child who then gets the vaccine they were supposed to get, that if they, are not eligible to receive the live attenuated nasal spray vaccine, that they get the trivalent inactivated and so forth. It's an important part of what needs to be managed in school-located vaccination programs.
Thanks, Linda. Well, it's 4 o'clock on the dot. I want to thank our speakers today, Linda Wharton, Mary Beth Hantz, Sam Graetzer. I want to thank the questioners for good questions and thank Michigan for that very nice compliment at the end. So thanks to everyone, and I think we feel like we've had a very successful first National Immunization Conference online. Bye-bye.